All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. This is live in Atlanta, Georgia, which you would know because you're literally here with me tonight. And what? We studied live, which is certainly beats the alternative. Okay, so this week's Torah portion is Vayeshev, and we are going to use our reference book, which is the Gunan Kedishin. Torah portion of Vayeshev begins... Tim, help me out here. What page? 243. Yes. Let's pass around those handouts. Fantastic. Thank you. All right. The topic tonight is when to smile and how to smile. Any dentists in the crowd?
They're not here.
They're not here tonight. Maybe they're watching. They might be watching or watching soon. Our dentist folk. So, look, here's the deal. Tonight, it's all about smiling and the power of a smile and how a smile can change the world. But before that, let's talk about how we got here. So, as a parenthetical note, although it's kind of important, today is a very special day on the Jewish calendar, on the Chabad calendar, certainly. It's the 20th day of Kislev, and the 19th and 20th days of Kislev are very special days in which we celebrate the liberation of the founder of the Chabad movement, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, from imprisonment a number of years ago. And it's a very special day on the Chabad calendar. It's collectively yesterday, the 19th of Kislev, and going into today is known as the Rosh Hashanah of the Hasidic movement. So it's a very special day, and it's very appropriate to be studying Torah, especially Chabad Torah, on this auspicious day. So, one of my favorite biblical characters, in fact, and in case Moses or Abraham are watching, this always gets awkward, perhaps my favorite biblical character is none other than
Joseph.
Joseph is the bomb. And that's the positive bomb mentioned, right? Joseph, Yosef, Hatzadik, Yosef, the righteous one, is just an inspiration. Talk about a riches to rags to riches story. It's got all of the pieces of drama that you could ever imagine. He grows up in the lap of luxury. When I say lap of luxury, he is loved, beloved by his father. He is the envied by his brothers, which obviously leads to some drama. But he's beloved. He special child. Loved by his father and his mother before she passed away, obviously. The brothers, though, however, are not so keen on him. We know the famous story, right? The brothers are jealous. They want to kill him. They settle on throwing him into a pit and selling him eventually as a slave. He ends up in Egypt. They tell their father, the brothers do, that he seems to have been ripped apart, shredded apart by a wild animal. And the end of the story is that he ends up being a slave in Egypt, and drama ensues. One thing before we go further. The Torah portion's name is Vayeshev. The title of the portion is Vayeshev. Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Mugur Aviv. That Yaakov settled. Vayeshev means settled. He settled in the land in which his father inhabited, the land of Canaan, which would later become, of course, the land of Israel. So Rashi comments, Vayeshev, what does Vayeshev mean? He settled. It means Yaakov wanted, at this stage in his life, finally, once and for all he wanted to do is settle down. And I don't mean what the bus drivers tell the kids when they're routing the bus. They turn, sit down and settle down. No, that's not what I meant. He wanted to settle down. He wanted to have a relaxing life without the drama. Think about Yaakov. Think about his drama, right? A twin always jostling with his brother, with Esav. The drama of his youth, heading into the drama of his early adulthood, with taking the blessings, having to run away out of fear of his life, going to his uncle's house, Lavan, Laban, who tricks him and deceives him, and he gets married a few times, or to a few wives. He has multiple children, he runs away, there's a confrontation there. He then meets Esau. There's a confrontation there. And his daughter's abducted. His sons wipe out a city. There's a lot of drama in Yaakov's life. In fact, later on, the Torah will tell us that when Yaakov, skipping way ahead in the story, when Yaakov eventually moves with the whole family to the land of Egypt, and Pharaoh says, "How old are you?" So he tells him his age. Yaakov tells Paro, his age, and he says, "My years, however, have been very difficult. I've had very difficult and bitter years." He had a difficult life. So Rashi quotes our sages at the beginning of this week's Torah portion. What did Yaakov want? He wanted to settle down in peace. And what happens? The drama begins. He had no idea that if he thought he had a dramatic life up until now, wait until he is faced with the prospect or faced with the reality of being separated and fearing his son dead or certainly missing his beloved son Joseph for 20 plus years. Let's go back to Joseph. So Joseph is in Egypt and he's working he's a servant in the house of Potiphar. It's important to know what Potiphar did. What did Potiphar do? What was his occupation? He was the chief what? Yes, he was the chief slaughterer. He was the butcher, right? When you wanted meat, Potiphar got it. Well, certainly for Pharaoh, he was the chief butcher, the chief slaughterer. What happens, of course, in the story of Joseph? We're just kind of moving through it till we get to the point that we want to focus on. Potiphar's wife takes a liking to Yosef. She tries to seduce him. Yosef refuses her advances. Then she gets upset. She accuses him of assault, falsely. He gets thrown into the slammer, into a dungeon somewhere, into a cell, whatever it looked like there in ancient Egypt. And there he is languishing. This is where we pick it up. And it's all the way at the end of the Torah portion. I kind of took you through all the narratives, except for the narrative of Yehuda, of Judah. We're skipping that. Let's begin. Tim, please begin on page 263, chapter 40. This is the last reading of our Torah portion, but this is where we pick it up inside.
Then after these words of Potiphar's wife, who badmouthed Joseph throughout Egypt, the attention was taken away from Joseph. The king of Egypt's butler and baker committed an offense against their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh became furious at his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker, and he placed them in the custody of the chief butcher's house in the prison where Joseph was held. The chief butcher assigned Joseph to be with them, and he attended to them. They were in custody for many days, a whole year.
Okay, so the Torah tells us that along with Yosef, we now have two more characters, and I'm sure there were more characters. But the Torah is highlighting these characters. We have now the chief butler and the chief baker. What about the candlestick maker? We don't know where he was. Okay, fine. So they join the crew. And they're there for a while. Continue, please.
Both of them, the kings of Egypt's butler and baker, were confined in the prison, had a dream. Each person had his dream on the same night as the other. Each person dreamed his own destiny. Joseph came to them in the morning. He saw them and, look, they were depressed. So he asked these officers of Pharaoh, who were with him in custody in his master's house, saying, "Why do your faces look so down today?" They said to him, "We've had a dream, but there is no one to interpret it." Joseph said to them, "Don't dream interpretations that come from God. Please tell me your dreams."
Okay, so we'll stop right here because I'll summarize the rest of the Torah portion, or the rest of the narrative to the end of the Torah portion, but I want to focus on verse number 7, which we'll pick up once again in just a moment. But here is what I want to say. So, they each have a dream, and their dream is not just a Baba Maisa dream. They woke up and they realized that these dreams that each of them had, this was something prophetic, speaking to their destiny, what would happen. And they were disturbed by it. So Yosef says, "What's wrong?" They said, "We had a dream. We don't know what it means." He says, "Okay." He says something interesting. He says, "Don't dream interpretations come from God?" In other words, God surely can tell you the answer. So therefore, tell them to me. I got the inside track, right? God can interpret it. So tell me what you got. Tell me your dreams. And they tell him their dreams. Famously, the butler's dream is about three tendrils. What are tendrils?
Like little vines.
Little vines. Sounds better than tendrils, right? Okay. I'm not a botanist, but a tendril, just whatever. So three little vines, and they each are flowering and budding, and grapes grow in his dream, right? The grapes are growing, and he squeezes them, squeezes the grapes into Pharaoh's cup, and he puts the cup in Pharaoh's hand, and then he wakes up. That's a dream. Well, listen, if you're a butler and you don't dream about wine, what are you dreaming about, right? I mean, it's your geschäft, it's your business. Okay, I mean, you should, right? Oh, those grapes I was squeezing, kedem. All right. Manischewitz. So then, right, then you have the, so, okay, then you have the baker's dream. What's the baker's dream? The baker has three baskets on his head, balanced on his head. Already it's awkward. And it's not tendril awkward, but it's still basket balance awkward. And then in the top basket, there are all these loaves of bread. And the loaves of bread are being picked at by the birds. The birds are eating from the basket on top of his head that had the breads in it. Yosef says, all right, folks, here's the interpretation. Although he does each one in turn, I told you both dreams, he does each one in turn. The butler, 3 days, you're going to be restored and once again serve Pharaoh's hand. Give the wine to Pharaoh. And the baker, in 3 days, you will be executed. Your head will be chopped off and the birds will eat your remains. Right? Terrible. And then Joseph says to the butler, because the butler was going to make it out, he says, don't forget me. And of course, the Torah portion ends that he forgot him. He didn't remember, he forgot him. Vayishkachehu, and he actually forgot him. Okay, but we want to focus on verse number 7. This is before they tell him the dreams. Take a look at verse, I'm going to read it again, and I want to, because I want to put the emphasis on the right ideas, or specific ideas. Okay, before verse 7, this is important. Before verse number 7, do we know who the butler and the baker are? I'm sorry, let me ask again. Do we know that these individuals are the butler and the baker?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do we know that they were the royal butler and baker?
Yeah.
Yep. Do we know that they were thrown into prison?
Yeah.
Of course. Do we know, I don't know if we know why. We don't know why. Okay, but we know who they are and that they were thrown in prison and that Yosef was assigned to tend to them, right? And that's it says that. That's verse 2, 3, and 4. It's all straight up text. In verse 5, we're going to get to verse 7 in a second. In verse 5, it says both of them. Who both of them? Look at the emdat. The king of Egypt's butler and baker who were confined in the prison. So it again emphasizes for the second time that who are the people with Yosef that we're talking about in our story? The chief butler, the chief baker, who were thrown in the same prison as Yosef, right? Verse number 7. Look at this. He saw Yosef came to them in the morning. Who's this? Verse 6. Yosef came to them in the morning. Who's them? The two characters. He saw them. Who? Yeah. And look, they were depressed. Who's they? Done. Let's continue. So he asked these officers of Pharaoh, who were with him in custody in his master's house. Whoa, that's extra.
In his master's house.
Oh, because he was imprisoned. He didn't have to go too far. Potiphar, who was the royal butcher, apparently had a dungeon in his abode. So he was in prison. It's a thing. I don't know. So, you know, some people have a swimming pool. Some people have a cell. It's whatever, you know, tennis courts. It's everyone's got their, you know, it's, hey, whatever. Yeah. Listen, his friends like Dungeons and Dragons. I'm kidding. That's such a 90s reference. Okay. So look, so they were imprisoned in the butcher's prison. But again, look at 7. So it doesn't say, the Torah doesn't say, so he asked them, why are your faces so down today? It reiterates who they were. It says, so he asked the officers of Pharaoh who were with him in custody in his master's house. We know who they are. Are you with me? Mm-hmm. It's been using pronouns for the last 2 verses. suddenly it depicts it again, who we're talking about. It's in the Hebrew, you have Pasuk Hey, the fifth verse, Vayachalmu, they dreamt. Chalom Shnehem, two dreams. Ish Chalomo, each one his own dream, etc. Verse 6, Vav, Vayavo el Alehem Yosef Baboker. He came, Yosef came to them. Vayaro Sam, he saw them. Vihi numbs off him. They were sad, they were depressed. It should have been Vayishalu. The Torah could have just said, and he asked them, why are your faces so downcast? We know who he was speaking to. It's abundantly clear. But no, the Torah interjects a whole line. Vayishal, and he asks, who? Esserise Paro, the officers of Pharaoh, Asher Ito Bemishmar, who were with him in the prison, Beis Adonav, in the house of his master. It's like, I know this. Why the detail again? It may seem like a very technical question. And if you're a writer, you know, sometimes you write he and sometimes you write Joe. You know, you'll intersperse the name with the pronouns, and that's how you keep narratives flowing. But I'm asking this question because, first of all, primarily because the commentaries ask this question. Many biblical commentaries ask this question. The text seems to be a little bit awkward because it's referring already to them. They've been introduced. We're already in pronoun mode. And then it goes back to the introductions. Come on, who needs that? So open up your Torah studies text. Let's look at two classic approaches to understanding this. We're going to look at, just so you have a sense of the arc of the class, we're going to, so we've asked the question, we're going to ask another question soon. We're going to look at some classical answers given in the commentaries. We're going to not be satisfied by those classical answers. We're going to look at some ethical teachings and ethics of our fathers, and then we're going to come back to an incredible interpretation of this Joseph narrative that the Rebbe gave. So let's first look at some classic interpretations. Reb David, please, if you will, please read. Hold on, I'll tell you in a moment. It's text. Oh, text number 2. Rabbi Samson Rafal Hirsch. Take a look at what he writes.
The way people ordinarily look at the world and at objects is different from the way Joseph did. Ordinarily, one sees things in a general way, whereas the wise person sees in every person and everything its unique and its unique nature and distinct qualities. The former interacts with the businessmen or teachers, that is, general classes and categories of people, while the latter always keeps his sight on the person, emphasis added, with whom he is speaking, with all his characteristics and all of his associations.
So let me just explain just simply what he's saying. Most people generalize others, and they don't really pay attention to the details. It's like, yeah, you're this. They judge you by your vocation or just the role that you play in society. So I give you a simple example. You know, when you're at a store and you go to check out or whatever, most of us don't necessarily pay attention to the person. You pay attention to the role. Okay, you're the checkout person. You're the person working for the airlines at the gate. It's like an anonymous, faceless type of thing. But certain people pay attention to the details. Continue.
Not for one moment did Joseph forget the prisoners, their nature, and the reason they were there. He maintained a clear and present view of their entire situation. They were imprisoned temporarily, which meant they could still be released the next day. So, too, they were with him, which might have given Joseph the vague assumption that since they were only being held under arrest until the investigation into their crimes had been concluded, they might yet have a positive influence on his own fate. Perhaps his heart told him, divine providence has brought us together. Precisely because he always kept sight of the entire person He noticed everything they said and did, and could connect their dreams to their distinct personalities. Because of his distinctive personality, he knew how to understand and assess everything he saw and heard.
Thank you. So Rabbi Hirsch says the following. Yosef was the type of person who paid attention to the other, who knew the other, got the other, paid attention to the details, and knew what was going on. And he said, look, these two people are not just prisoners. These people are officers. They're leaders. They're, in Hebrew we would say, chashuv. They're important people. And they may only be here temporarily. And if and when they get out, they might be able to pull some strings for me. In other words, he wasn't just, you know, I'm in prison.
He's not just a tzaddik.
Say it again.
He's not just a tzaddik.
No, that's exactly the point. He was already working connections and wheeling and dealing, huh?
Yeah, well, I have a problem.
You don't like this?
Not part of it, but part of it, I don't. I like the idea.
By the way, we're also going to challenge it, but I want to hear if you, because I think we're, yeah.
I'm going to challenge something that you said also.
I mean, challenge.
It makes sense. He understands who they are, so he's got insight into the
right.
dreams. But I'm bothered by the comment by Rabbi Hirsch that he was getting involved with them because they may have a positive influence on his own fate.
Mm.
So he's putting his
yes
in them and not in God.
Well, yeah.
And, you know,
says that's why he got punished.
But then I also read the very last line where it says, and he forgot him, and later on too,
mm-hmm.
the butler forgot what had happened, but I had read somewhere that Yosef also prayed to God to make him forget because he felt that he had sinned in
putting too much stock in him. But okay, so it could be that way. There's also commentary that says that he was punished for 2 years languishing in prison because he put his stock in the butler. Either way, it doesn't seem out of character based on those interpretations to say what Rabbi Hirsch says, that indeed whilst they were in prison, he was working the angles. He's saying, okay, these guys may have pull. These guys are ministers, and hey, everyone needs to eat, right? Pharaoh likes his wine and likes his carbs, so you know, at some point maybe they're going to be released, and at some point they might have something good to say about me. So I think it makes sense, but I like David's point, which is that, you see, we call Yosef a tzaddik. It's like, oh, he altruistic, you know, loves everybody. Well, there's a lot of self-interest. Based on text 2's interpretation, one could argue that maybe a big piece of it was self-interest motivated. It's like, what can I get out of these people? It's almost like Rabbi Hirsch is saying, that the people that don't pay attention to others may miss out on opportunities for connection, for benefits, right? Whereas if you get to know someone, you get to know what they do, who they are, what they like, then you can, I'm not going to use the word manipulate, oh wait, I just said that, but they can now pull some strings and orchestrate things to make some benefits for themselves. And is that so terrible? Certainly not in Yosef's case, to get out of jail where he's falsely imprisoned. That's not a bad thing at all.
So we're not supposed to rely on miracles.
Right. So you're saying, so what did he do wrong? Right.
Agents of Hashem.
Right. You know, it's an interesting question. Why was Yosef ultimately punished, I mentioned before, for trusting? The answer that I've seen, the only answer that I've seen that kind of, for me, that resonates, not the only answer that's out there, but one of the answers that resonates for me is that Yosef, Hatzadik, being held to such a high standard, shouldn't have been looking for a human medium for God's salvation. He should have been completely trusting that somehow, some way, it's going to come directly from the source to swoop him up. So he shouldn't have been looking for what we would call the diplomacy route, right? If I buddy-buddy with these guys, then one day when they're out, they can help me. But clearly, Rabbi Hirsch is taking what the sages say, the classic teaching that Yosef put his stock, put his trust in the butler, to say that's why the Torah tells us again, he's answering the question, why does the Torah tell us again in verse 7 that he asked these officers of Pharaoh who were with him in custody, why does it mention that? Because why did he care how they're doing today? He asked them, how are you doing today? You look downcast. Is everything all right? Can I help you? Why? Because they were officers of Pharaoh. That's why the Torah re-emphasizes that they were officers. They were bigwigs or whatever. They were...
knockers.
But yeah, big. They were big knackers. Why? Because that's why he paid attention, according to Rabbi Hirsch text 2. That's why he paid attention. Why? Because they were officers who were with him. Because they were with him, they might feel something for him if they were friends and buddies or whatever. Okay, let's take a look at another commentary. This goes back another few hundred years to the 15th century. This is the Abarbanel. You know the Abarbanel's theme song? Abarbanel. Okay, that's not. That's Schlock Rock. Go. That's an 80s reference. Text number 3. Sindrine, can we... 60. Well, no. The Schlock Rock version, which is the Jewish parody version. Lenny Solomon, that was the 80s. All right, text number... 150, I want to say 156 in the English. Sindrine, can we throw you in right away?
So, eighth question. Why does it say, and he asked Pharaoh's chamberlain, who were with him in the prison of his master house? The Torah has already mentioned them since they are the subject of his story. Why then does it name them once again? He could have just written, and he has them.
Now again, this is the question that we asked before. It's a technical question. But why, after introducing to us the fact that these officers were in prison with him, and then he was attending to them, why does it say again, and then he asked the chamberlains that were with him? Why does it specify who they were? By the way, the Abarbanel says this is the eighth question. He has a series of questions on these verses. This is question number 8. Continue, please.
Working as a servant for his fellow prisoner, since they were in fact ministers, meant that Joseph would prepare their food, their beds, their clothes, and their food.
You see, they weren't on equal footing in prison. Joseph was there, and these two people... Oh, no, that's not how it worked. Even in prison, as Abarbanel explains, they were the chamberlains, they were the ministers. So Joseph attended to them. What does it mean, attended to them? He made their beds. He prepared their food, their clothes, their shoes. He was their personal attendant. Continue, please.
Therefore, Joseph came to them in the morning, as is the custom of diligent servants, who come each and every morning to their masters, killing them to prepare their clothes and to give them water in order to wash their hands and faces. Now, when he saw that they were troubled, he saw that perhaps it was because their beds had not been properly prepared.
Very pragmatic, right? It's like, oh, did I mess up? Continue.
Had they been regular prisoners, he would have been unconcerned, but since they were Pharaoh's ministers, and he was appointed to serve them during their incarceration, he had to inquire. This answers the eighth question.
Let me clarify, before you continue the last paragraph, his eighth question. The question was, why does the Torah tell us that he went to check on them and ask them how they're doing? Who, not just them, the officers, the ministers of Pharaoh that were with him in his master's house. Why does it tell us who they were? We know who they were. The Torah, according to the Abarbanel, that's why he checked on them. Otherwise, who cares how they're feeling? So, you're having a bad day. Join the club. So according to the Abarbanel, why did he check on them? Because they were the ministers who were with him, and he was meant to attend to them. And if they're not happy, it's like a hotel. If you're in the hospitality business and your guests aren't happy, well, it's not guests, whatever. If your job in prison is to take care of the other prisoners, these ministers, and they're not happy, clearly you're not doing your job. And if you're not doing your job, that could be dangerous. So he is checking on them to see what's going on, and that's why the Torah mentions who they were to explain his checking on them. Hold on 1 second. Let's do the last paragraph, please.
Nevertheless, since he saw a difference in that day from those days of their detention, he thought to ask them, why are your faces sad today, meaning this day more than other days?
Okay, so this adds another piece to it that he said, why are your faces so downcast? Why do they look so down? Why do you look so sad today? In other words, he noticed the distinction between today and other days. It was worse today than typical depression of being inside a prison. Okay, fine. Now I want to ask a question. We have the explanation of Rabbi Hirsch, that he checked on them because he wanted to curry favor with them so that they might be able to help him get out. We have the explanation of the Barbanel, that he checked on them because that was his job, in essence. What's common to both of these interpretations?
That he's lower than they are.
Number one, good. Good, he's depending on them on some level, right? Either to get out or for his own job and or safety, security. Good, what else? What's common to both these interpretations vis-a-vis why he checked on them? Bottom line, why did he check? Why did he ask them, why do you look so sad today? Did he care about them? According to both these interpretations, who did he really care about?
Himself.
Cared about himself. He either cared about...
He wasn't doing himself.
That's a second. Right. Either he cared about himself to get out, so he needed to maintain, he needed to keep a friendship, right? A kind of fraternity with them, either on that level. Or he was concerned about his job, but either way, he's only asking how they're doing, according to both these interpretations. Why?
Because it happened to him.
Because of himself. Because of himself, self-interest. Now, is self-interest bad? It's not bad. But it certainly paints this whole story in a certain way. It puts Joseph in a certain position over here. Here's a guy. A lot of things have happened to him bad. He cares about himself. He's still trying to get out. He's wanting to succeed. And therefore, he asks about them. It's not really about them. It's really about him. Okay. We're going to take, ultimately, in this class, a different approach as to why he asked about their welfare. Why he asked them, you look sad today. What's going on? Tell me about your dreams. Let me help you. According to these other opinions, he only asked all those questions for self-serving purposes. We're going to ultimately land on an interpretation that explains this in a completely selfless fashion. But first, we need to look at the ethics of smiles. The ethics of smiling. We're going to look at a series of texts mainly from Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers. And these texts talk about maintaining a positive demeanor and a happy disposition, and showing a happy face, a smiling face, even when a person feels maybe not so happy. Let's go through these texts and let's uncover some brilliant teaching. So again, let's put the Yosef story on the side for a moment and let's focus on what Judaism teaches us about how we should carry ourselves in the presence of others. Let's begin with text 4a. Steve, 158.
Rabbi Matya, the son of Harash, would say, be the first to greet every man, be a tail to lions rather than a head to foxes.
Interesting that he has these two statements in the same, Mishnah, if you will. But let's focus on the first thing that Rabbi Matya, the son of Harash, said. He says, be the first to greet every man. Havi makdim b'shlom kol adam. You should always be the first one to greet the other. Please, text 4b, one more.
One ought to say, it's enough if I...
What?
One ought not to say, it's enough if I greet those who greet me. Rather be the first to greet every man, emphasis added, even those who appear to be your lesser. You should greet them first.
Somebody might say, I'll be cordial, I'll be polite, right? I'll be nice, I'll be a mensch. If somebody says hi to me, I'll say hi back. But I should be the one saying hi to everybody. Now, if you're in Manhattan, this could prove to be very cumbersome. Because you're standing on the street corner, Fifth Avenue, and there's a light and people start gathering and congregating on the corner. It's good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. Right? It's like, what's with this guy? And then you have like on your forehead, Avot 415. Right? Be the first to greet every person. doesn't mean it's not gender specific. Adam here is general, a human being. Be the first to greet the other. Don't wait. The Midrash Shmuel says, text 4b, Midrash Shmuel is a commentary on Pirkei Avot. That's 4b. Midrash Shmuel says, don't wait for them. Don't just say, okay, if you say hi to me, I'll say hi back to you. I'm not going to be more polite than you. So if you're polite, I'll be polite back. But I'm not going to initiate the politeness. What is this? I need to initiate? Yes. That's what Rav Masiya ben Charash is saying. Rav Masiya ben Charash is saying, you be the one to initiate the greeting. Okay. And then he adds something else. Even those who appear to be your lesser, someone who's lower than you, greet them first. Good. Now you might think, this is probably being taught to someone who has a lot of time in their hands. Right? Someone who, you know, is a little bit bored and anyway is wasting their time. So instead of wasting your time, be nice to people. But if somebody's really busy, I don't mean like semi-busy, but really preoccupied with other stuff, there's no way that Jewish ethics is asking of us that amidst our busyness to actually greet others. Of course not. There's no way. Indeed, it does. Text number 5. Sarah.
They said of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai that he did not leave unstudied scripture, Mishnah, Gemara, Halakha, Agada, details of the Torah, details of the scribes, inferences.
It's a kavachomer. I'm not sure what that is. A minori ad maius. It's Latin to translate Hebrew or Aramaic. I don't know why. I don't know how that helps. It's translating one foreign language into another. Basically, it's a halachic. It's a legalistic way of interpreting something. Don't worry about it.
The minor to the major.
Yeah. If okay, keep on going. Yeah. In other words, he went through all of these areas of study. Scripture, so Torah, Mishnah, Gemara, Halacha, Agada, etc.
Calendrical computations, gematrias, speech of the ministering angels, the speech of spirits, the speech of palm trees, washers, parables, and fox feet. Great matters or small matters. Great matters mean the mystical, masay.
That's the chariot of Ezekiel, the discussion of the chariot.
Small matters mean the Talmudic discussions of Abaye and Rava.
And those are not small matters at all, right? Those are amazing. Those are brilliant. But to him, those were the minor things. Here you're talking about a person who was so well-versed, he was well-versed in basically every area of Jewish scholarship. And every area, not every, but in many areas of other scholarship. He had astronomy, the calendrical computations, it's basically astronomy. He had gematria, numerology, mathematics. He spoke the language of angels. He spoke the language of the spirits. He spoke the language of the trees. Now, I don't know what palm trees are discussing, but that's because of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He knew. And he had all this stuff. So imagine how his mind was filled with all of these wisdoms. You would think if anyone would have an excuse not to be the greeter, hey, how's it going? I haven't seen you in a while. Everything okay? If there's anybody who would have an excuse not to be the greeter, it would be him. And yet, text number 6. Jillian, please read this.
It was related of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai that no man ever gave him greeting first, even a heathen in the marketplace.
No one ever beat him to a shalom aleichem. In other words, he always was the first to initiate the conversation. Imagine, somebody with so much in his mind, so much brilliant wisdom and depth and scholarship, should be greeting everyone in the marketplace. How's it going?
When he took a walk, you know, he didn't study.
He probably didn't get out to
walk. He took a walk.
But you would imagine, even on his walks, no, I'm with you, but even on his walks, you would think that his mind was elsewhere. I would say this. If I saw Albert Einstein walking down the street, I would not expect him to notice me. Because here's a guy whose head is most probably in some other realm of thought. So to notice, it's probably not shaykh, it's probably not happening. And it's not about me, it's just the reality. He's just probably not noticing. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai no man ever greeted him first. He was always aware, and it's not only that his head wasn't too much in the clouds and he wasn't, you know, the absent-minded professor, whatever it is. It's not just that. It's that he was a mensch. Pirkei Avot tells us how to be a mensch. It's not halacha. 62 of the 63 tractates are about the law. Pirkei Avot, which is what we're studying now, is in this section, is about beyond the letter of the law, being a mensch. And what does it mean to be a mensch? It means greet people, and you should be the greeter. Don't wait for someone else. You initiate the greeting. Yeah.
So if you were in New York, like you said, he wouldn't have to worry about being the first, because they're not going to greet him.
Right. He would.
New Yorkers are not.
They're not greeters, no. In fact, if you greet in New York, they'll be like, why are you saying that?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, even, and this is true even in Jewish neighborhoods sometimes. Right. Yeah, you go to Crown Heights, and it's like you see them like a Shabbos, they're like...
And they don't answer, I said good Shabbos.
It's like, oh, in the South, it's very warm and friendly. I'm saying in Brooklyn, and even in very religious Orthodox neighborhoods... Yeah, it's like, do I know you? It's like, why are you saying hi? It's like, in fact, so every year we take our teens up for Shabbaton in February. So one year, my teens, they told me they were laughing hysterically. I'm like, what's going on? We met up at a later point. And they said, oh, sorry, I was with them the entire time. But anyway, they tell me that that they've been going over to people and saying pajamas instead of kachavas. And people were not even noticing. It's like, pajamas, and pajamas. It became like a joke that you could literally get away with saying pajamas because no one's even listening. So you just say pajamas, and like, pajamas. So feel free to try that. I mean, you can't just say pajamas to people. You can't like yell pajamas. They'll be like, what are you saying? But if you say it in the right way, pajamas, then you can actually get away with it. So kids, try that at home and let me know how that works. Okay, so getting back to the discussion.
You know what you're going to hear Sunday, Saturday.
Yeah, exactly. We had a lot of pajama greetings. So the point here is about the menschlichkeit, being greeting someone warmly and being the first. Let's take a look at text number 7, and here we get into the idea, into the notion of smiling. Ray, please read text 7. Interesting, right? So who are we talking about? Who's this he? So this is the blessing that in a few Torah portions, Yaakov gives to his sons. Yaakov, Jacob, on his deathbed, blesses each of his 12 sons. This is the blessing that he gives to his son, Judah, Yehuda. So he tells Yehuda, Chachlili einayim yoyin uleven shinayim echalav. Judah, you are red-eyed from wine and white-toothed from milk. What does that mean? What, he's blessing him to be red-eyed from wine, bloodshot eyes? Like, what's going on here? So most commentators explain what it means is that in the ancestral land in Israel that would be given to Judah, it's a blessing and a prophecy and a promise for the future that on Yehuda's land there will be vineyards that will produce abundant wine, and there will be the pastures for lots of cows that will produce milk. And so that's what it means, red-eyed from wine and white-toothed from milk. There will be a lot of vineyards and a lot of cattle on your land. That's what he's telling his son, Judah. It's nice. The Talmud says something else. The Talmud derives a personal conduct mandate from these words, text 7. It's not literal. It's beautiful. It's allegorical. Take it away. Yeah, David.
Rabbi Yochanan said, one who, by smiling affectionately, shows his teeth to his friend is better than one who gives him milk to drink. For it is stated, he is white-toothed from milk. Read not white-toothed, but showing the teeth.
Showing the teeth. So what it means is, it says, the Talmud says, uleven shinayim mechalav, read it that it's better to bare your teeth when you smile, to show your teeth by smiling, that's better mechalav rather than from, in other words, rather than giving milk. So sometimes you think, what's better? To give someone something or to give them affection and love? I guess it depends on the context. You know, if somebody needs, you know, a glass of something to drink, then, you know, they're in the desert. You can smile at them, but they're dying of thirst. So give them a beverage. If it's milk, it's milk. But in general, what the Talmud is saying is that sometimes how you give or your disposition is greater than what you're actually doing. Because you can give someone something, but with a sour disposition or negative disposition, and it can ruin the whole experience. The other person feels like, I don't even want to take it now. Because, like, you're only giving it in such, you're giving it in such a way where you're so, you know, it's causing you so much pain. Don't bother. So the Talmud says it's better to smile sometimes than give a glass of milk without smiling. Because that's what it's about, the connection. Okay, so it's a beautiful message here. So far we have 2 points. Number one, be a greeter. Number two, smile and be happy around others. So far, so good. I'll read text 9a and 9b. 9a and 9b, this again comes from Avot, chapter 1 and chapter 3. Shammai would say, receive every man with a pleasant countenance. What does that mean?
Smile.
Text 9b comes from chapter 3 of Pirkei Avot. Rabbi Yishmael would say, be yielding to a leader, affable to the tishchoret. We're going to explain that in a moment. And receive every man with joy. What does that mean? Receive the last part, receive every man with joy. Be happy and smile. So, do you notice a difference between 9a and 9b? 9a says, receive every man with a pleasant countenance. 9b says, receive every man with joy. In the Hebrew, it's Heve mekabel et kol adam besever panim yafot, or Heve mekabel et kol adam besimcha. So, either receive every man with a pleasant countenance, or receive every man with joy. What's the difference?
Joy seems more active, just a pleasant countenance.
So
it's happier.
It's happier.
Countenance is more of an exterior.
Yeah.
It's your speed.
Putting on the show, right?
Good. So the Meiri in text 10 explains that what is the first statement? A receive every person with a pleasant countenance means even if you're not happy to see them, smile anyway. In other words, you're looking at somebody, and you're like, oh, you again. Not that we should ever think this, but just in case it would ever happen that we would think, I need to be seeing you right now in my life. I don't need this. But anyway, if case that would ever happen, chas v'shalom, God forbid, right? We should nonetheless receive every person with a pleasant countenance. Smile. And that's how he explains in text 10. Say, first of all, panim, face, means like a facade, like an external. It doesn't have to be internal. You don't have to like them. But on the face, and show a smile. And sever is like svara. Svara means like logic or like a thought or an impression that you have about something. So it means give them the impression that you're happy to see them, even if you're not. So again, even a situation where, either because you're in a bad mood, or because they are who they are, you're not excited to see them, and you're not excited to be there, whatever it is, if you're there, show a smiling countenance, show a happy face. Okay, we're not going to read text then, because I just paraphrased it. What about, so that's the first text, that's receive every man with pleasant countenance. What does it mean to receive every man with joy? What does joy mean? Does joy mean faking something, or joy means something deeper? Something deeper. Let's take a look at text 11, again, Midrash Shmuel. Tim.
Rabbi Yisrael writes, the directive to receive every man with joy goes beyond Shemaiah's call in Avot 1:15 for a pleasant countenance. For a person can show a pleasant face while his heart feels the opposite. In order to be joyful, one must actually direct his soul to joy so that eventually he naturally feels good.
So what we have here is a progression from chapter 1 of Ethics to chapter 3. In chapter 1 it says, if you're not so happy, you're happy about them or whatever it is, smile anyway. In chapter 3 it says, really be happy to see them. Really be happy to see them. What do you want me to do? I'm not happy to see them. So, okay, that's why it's chapter 3. You got to work on yourself, he says. In order to be joyful, one must actually direct his soul to joy so that eventually he naturally feels glad. In other words, this is going to require a lot of internal work to try to get yourself, however it works, and every person, every situation is going to be different, but try to get yourself inside to really feel happy and pleasant to see this person. That could be a huge step. That could be a lifetime work. But don't let that get in the way of chapter 1. Smile anyway. So chapter 1 says, be a mensch. Smile. It's a nice thing to do. Chapter 3 says, ultimately, try to develop a real, genuine love and affection, even for that person. Take a look at text 12. David, please read this one.
Rabbi, there's an English song, and I don't know the beginning, but it goes, put on a happy face.
Put on a happy face, yeah. I was thinking that in my head. Put on a happy face, right? And soon you'll realize, I forget the exact lyrics, but I'm paraphrasing. If you put on a happy face, even when you don't feel happy, soon you'll be happy. Happier, or dancing, whatever it is. Exactly. Text 12, here we have the Bar Tanura. Not the wine, the commentary.
Mm-hmm. Receive every person. Before every person, whether a little or a child, you should stand with joy.
It's interesting how he says this. Whether a child, whether a leader or a child, in other words, whether this person is greater than you, in which case you might stand in awe, or whether they're below you, so to speak, whereas you wouldn't maybe take them seriously, you should receive them, you should stand besimcha with joy. Now, here's a very interesting thing. Text 13, Midrash Shmuel again, Midrash Shmuel is one of the major commentaries on Pirkei Avot and ethics. So here we have an explanation of the chapter 3 Mishnah. Remember we had the Mishnah said a few different things. It said, be yielding to a leader, affable to the tishkoret, and receive a man with joy. So what does that mean? So here he talks about, text 13 brings everything together. Sindrine.
One can also say that the meaning is this. Yielding to a leader, Rosh refers to God, who directs and is the head Rosh of all the world. One must be as light as an eagle in serving God. Not only when he is openly good to you, but even when he afflicts you. Being affable to the dark, Tishkoret, refers to dark time and is a euphemism for suffering. The sages have further urged us that even if one is suffering from an affliction and someone comes to speak with him, he should not receive him with a sour face, but with joy. You may be experiencing personal pain, but you should still greet others with joy when they come to you. Therefore, it says, receive every person with joy. Any person who comes to you, whether to harm you or do you well, receive them with joy. For even if they come to harm you, since they are ultimately a messenger of God, you should receive them with joy.
How does a person actually live by this, right? Talk about setting a high standard. Even someone who's coming to harm you.
Yeah, this will be the end of Israel.
Well, yeah. But it doesn't say, by the way, well, one second, receive them with joy doesn't also mean that you can't carry a weapon and no, use it. Receive them with joy. You can smile as you got them down. You may be, right? You could smile. I'm with you. And so I think this is taken in a certain context. Even if someone maybe doesn't have the best intentions and in the past they've hurt you and whatever it is, on your end, you should have the simcha. You should have the joy. This is obviously not something that is legally required. This is something that is lefnim yishurat hadin. This is something beyond the letter of the law. And midat chasidut, a pious and a very like above and beyond approach. This is what it says in Midrash Shmuel. I mean, this is what he teaches. Now, I want to mention something interesting. I just want to explain what he says. Again, going back to text 9b, which is the Mishnah that we're focusing on, Rabbi Shmuel would say, be yielding to a leader. How did he translate it? How did he explain it? Hevikal l'rosh. Be yielding to a leader means be yielding to God. God is the Rosh. God is the leader, the ultimate leader with a capital L. So when God, whatever God sends your way, that's what Hashem wants. And affable to the Tishkoret. Tishkoret means the dark. What is the darkness? Negative times. Even if, God forbid, Hashem sends us difficult times, we should be noach. Noach means pleasant, affable. We should accept it. Receive everyone with joy, even if they're the bearer of bad news, whatever it is. You should always have that pleasant disposition.
Rabbi, if you could see the angel of death, if there is such a person, are you going to smile?
I'm with you. It's not an easy task. And again, the question is, how literal does he mean? Or within you and I, right? So the person that drays you a cup, right? The person that gets under your nerves, right? That makes you sometimes have a bad day. Could you somehow transform your whole, not your whole, but something about how you perceive that whole interaction to where they don't bother you, you don't let them get to you, and you're even pleasant toward them, and you even appreciate, you know, who they are on some level? I think it's possible. I'm not saying it's easy. I think it's possible. And I think maybe that's what he's saying. Yeah.
Does that tie into this statement? No one can make you angry unless you allow them to.
100%. But that's step one. That's not letting them bring you down. But this is more. This is having makabalat kaldam besimcha, to receive every person, even the nudnik, with joy. Right? Even the one that gets under your skin. Besimcha. Again, this is a very high level. It's not basic. It's not like, yeah, you got to start with this right away. This is advanced. The first step is put on a smile, even when you don't feel like smiling.
And it's not talking about a war situation.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I don't think it's literally talking about life. And I don't think it's literally
talking about it. It doesn't matter.
Right. It's, well, it's lahagdil Torah ladirat. We're expanding. Now, so now let's bring it back to Yosef. Because what we learned so far are four major ideas. From the Pirkei Avot, we had three different missions. It doesn't matter. You can look back at it later, but we learned four things. Number one, you be the one to greet others even if they don't greet you. Put on a happy face even when you don't feel so happy. Even when negative things come from God, be happy. And what was the fourth? Treat people like a mensch, even when they may not be treating you like a mensch. These are the four teachings. Who embodied them in our story? Think about it. What does the Torah tell us? Yosef is in prison. Let's put aside the two commentaries, Rabbi Hirsch and the Abarbanel that we had before, about his own personal interest in that. Put aside that. Let's look at it from a fresh perspective. What happens? Yosef's in prison. Is he having a good day or not? In general, is his life in a good place or not a good place? It's a dark place, right? It's a dark place, okay? There are other people in the room with him or the... Yes, okay? How does he feel about them? Maybe not so happy. He has to serve them? Why? He doesn't even deserve to be there in the first place. But what does he do? He's the first to... greet them. How are you? Oh, he's the greeter. Boom. Even though he's going through difficult times, he puts on a smile. Well, it doesn't say that he smiles at them, but the impression is that he's greeting them with joy and he's noticing how they feel. Yosef is a living embodiment of this midat chasidut, of this very beautiful way of living, where no matter what's going on inside, no matter the difficulties that you're going through inside, internally, and no matter how annoying or whatever it is that other person is on the outside, you're able to maintain positive, joyous, outgoing, greeter-ish, that's not a word, but your disposition. You are, and not just faking it, but you really genuinely care and love and are concerned about the other. This is Yosef. This is the story that we read. And so, in this understanding, we have an unbelievable lesson. This lesson is articulated by the Rebbe in a very, the one piece that's missing. How does this answer the question of why the Torah reintroduces us to who they were? Text 14. Who just read? I forgot. Sandrine. So, Steve. Text 14 from Ramban.
And he asked Pharaoh,
Pharaoh's chamberlains who were with him in the prison of his master's house, saying, "Why are your faces sad today?" The Torah could have simply said, "And he asked them, saying." It elaborated to praise Joseph. He was just a young servant asking after two great royal ministers who were in the house of his master, who hated him. Any of them could have had his head if they had so commanded. Nevertheless, he was not afraid to ask them.
Remember what we said before about being a greeter? And we said greet someone even if they're greater than you or even if they're smaller than you. He greeted someone, two people who were much greater than him. They were the big chamberlains. They were the ministers. They were, you know, they could have put the word out there and they could have got Yosef in big trouble, maybe even killed. And he's asking them, how are you doing? Sounds like a chutzpah. But he did it from a place of purity, genuine concern, because he was a living embodiment of all of that ethical teaching that we just had a few minutes ago. And now the Rebbe brings it all together in this magnificent text number 15. There's a very famous talk of the Rebbe about what Yosef did that day.
Of what relevance to us is the lengthy account of the chamberlain's dream of Yosef the Torah? As it is well known, every word in the Torah is precise and accounted for. So how is all this relevant to us? Yes, the explanation is this. Yosef was stolen from his father's home. He was sold as a slave, which is the worst thing that can be done to a person. In Egypt itself, he was placed in a prison where he committed no crime at all. Normally, a person in such a situation would be filled with anger at the entire world, and with a special hatred for Cairo's officials, since it was one such official who threw him in prison in the first place. However, when Yosef noticed the sad faces of the chief cupbearer and the baker, he took an interest in them and asked, "Why are your faces sad today?" They weren't lacking food or drink, and merely seemed uncomfortable. But even this bothered Yosef. Moreover, it would seem that...
In other words, he had every reason in the world to not care about anyone else in the world, let alone the enemy. The leadership of Egypt had gotten him into this mess. He was framed by one of the leaders of Egypt, one of these, chamberlains. He would have every excuse in the world to have no sympathy and no care and no place in his heart whatsoever for these people. Continue.
Moreover, it would seem that the cause of their sad faces was obvious, such that Yosef had no need to ask them about it. Nevertheless,
in other words, why are they sad? Because they're in prison, obviously. It's like, well, why are you so sad today? Oh, have you seen what's going on here? It's like, are you kidding me? These bars, maybe? You know, continue.
Nevertheless, Yosef interposed himself, took an interest, and asked him, basing himself on a vague suspicion, "Why are your faces sad? And is there something I can do to help?" All this, despite the fact that Yosef had nothing to do with and had not caused their predicament. On the contrary, it was they who were friends with the wicked person who had sent him there.
Pharaoh, right, i.e. Pharaoh. It wasn't his fault. He wasn't from a place of guilt saying, "How are you doing?" because he did something. He had nothing to do with it. Continue.
And what came of all in Parshas
Mitzvah? The next week's Torah portion.
The Torah relates how Yosef went on to become the king's viceroy, and how through this he went on to save the entire world. Later on, there was a famine in all the land, a famine throughout the entire known world, and Yosef ended up providing for the world, all as a consequence of that deed, when Yosef offered his assistance to the chief cupbearer and baker.
And the Rebbe here draws, in again, it's a, I would say it's a, amongst the Rebbe's talks, it's one of the more well-known ones. The Rebbe draws this incredibly powerful message, and this is what we're going to end with today, that here you have someone who had every reason in the world to not care. And that's a nice way of saying it, to not at all care about these two people. What do I care if you feel, if you're happy or sad today? I don't know you. I don't owe you anything. You represent the enemy, people I don't like. I don't care. You're not having a good day. Good. I'm also not having a good life. So you're having a bad day? Join the club. Mazel tov. Good. I'm happy that you're sad. Misery loves company. No. He cares about them. Why does he care about them? He initiates the greeting. He asks them how they're doing. He takes an interest in their dreams. He helps interpret that. He cares. And we had this, I'm going to say cynical, somewhat cynical interpretation before. He only asked them for self-interest. Put that aside. This new interpretation, the Rebbe's view on the situation is, loved is probably a strong word, but he cared about them. He had compassion and love in his heart. He smiled at them. And he genuinely cared about the disposition, about the emotional state, the human state of another human being. And the Rebbe says, and you know what happened because of that? You know what happens when a person can break through all of the stuff that's going on inside that would drive a person to say, I don't care. And all the stuff outside, why you shouldn't, because of them, care about them. If you can break through that ice that stands between you and them, and you can warm yourself up to another human being, no matter who they are and no matter what you're going through, you just might save the world. You might just have the most incredible breakthrough of your life, and a breakthrough that literally affects the entire world. That's the story of Yosef. Here's one man who in a dungeon in Egypt smiles and cares and asks, and because of that, his life is changed, and the world is changed, and Jewish destiny is changed. And so the message here is that there's nothing small. There's nothing small in our lives. Everything, every small action, small reaction, every interaction, everything is significant. The message is how powerful it is to choose to act, I'm going to use the word like a supermensch, but I don't mean like ubermensch, that's like a different, that means something else. To act like, to really go beyond what's demanded, to be a mensch, even when you don't have to, even when you're totally justified not doing it, but to be a mensch, because you know it's right, and it just might change the world. Thank you for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.
And we all know someone who exemplifies this by far better than anyone else. His name is Ari Solch.
Thank you.
I know.
Thank you.